Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you every weekend here on News Talk 580 KMJ and on the internet at KMJ580.com. I say every weekend, but I'll let you know ahead of time. Next week, there will be no program because we've got a baseball doubleheader from Loyola Marymount with the Diamond Dogs taking on the Lions down there. So Hometown Heroes will not be heard next week. It will return the following week on March 28th. Last week, if you listened to the program, you heard me talk to a former prisoner of war from the Pacific Northwest by the name of Bud Kirchhoff, a Bataan Death March survivor. That was a very pleasant conversation, and in my travels with the Bulldog basketball team, I figured why not interview another former prisoner of war up in the Northwest who's been involved in the American Ex-Prisoners of War organization. But unlike Mr. Kirchhoff last week, Jerry Gleasing was not in the Pacific. He was in Europe, although his story starts on the plains of North Dakota in the small town. And let's start there, Jerry. Thanks for being with me. You grew up in a town called Lemoore, North Dakota.
Right.
Not to be confused with the town we have back in the San Joaquin Valley named Lemoore, L-E-M-O-O-R-E, which, by the way, is now a naval air station flying F-A-18 hornets. You ever heard of Lemoore, California?
No. Well, I have now.
You have now. There you go. Learn something every day. You weren't flying F-A-18 hornets. They were long from being invented. You were in a little bigger airplane. But is that something you thought about as a kid in North Dakota? I don't think there's a whole lot in Lemoore to keep your mind occupied. Did you have some little toy airplanes that you played with or anything?
Yes, I did.
How early did you think, you know what, I would love to get up there and fly around a bit?
Well, I took my first flight, I think I was probably about 5 years old. And we lived fairly close, our farm was fairly close to town, and we had a pasture between the buildings and the city. And a couple used it for in shows that they put on it, give people rides for money and that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
So they gave us a ride, and that was my first flight.
How old were you?
Well, I wasn't six yet because I wasn't in school, so I guess I was five, I would guess.
Did that kind of hook you right there?
Well, yes and no. I wanted to do it. We used to get frequent visitors on that farm that just fly in and land, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Without unannounced. There was no radio.
Didn't necessarily need a runway, huh? Pretty wide
no,
open.
No, not in those days. No,
and pretty windy, I imagine, right?
Well, I guess so. You forget the North Dakota wind when you leave. You know, you have to go back home to remember that there was. And there's some calm days, but we did have a lot of wind.
So you're good friends with the gentleman we had on last week, Bud Kirchhoff, who was on the other side of the world during the war. And while he was a prisoner of war, you were still in high school. But I want to ask, I often ask our guests on this program what they remember about December 7th, 1941, whether they are in the service yet or not, because that is the day that the Americans were drawn into World War II. Where were you on December 7th, 1941, and how did you find out that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor?
Well, I was with some friends when I first heard that there was this attack, and we were probably, I don't remember just what we were doing, but we were uptown in this town of 900, 1,000 people. And
that's 900 or 1,000, not 900,000.
No, 900 or, yeah.
Yeah,
about 1,000 people.
Gotcha.
And there's not 900,000 in all of North Dakota. But anyhow, that's when you heard it. And, you know, we talked about it, but I'm not sure any of us thought we would be involved with it. We were seniors in high school, and I think we just thought it'd be over by the time we got involved.
Little did you know.
That's right.
So did your number come up in the draft? How did you end up in the Army Air Corps?
No, I turned 18 in the summer there in August, and I was working on a threshing crew as a drive, you know, hauling bundles on a threshing crew, and didn't get to town to register for the draft. And then I came home on a Saturday night, and I think I left Sunday morning or Monday to go to college. So here I am in this big city of Fargo, and hadn't registered yet. So I'm breaking the law. And shortly after I got there, there was a sign went up on the bulletin board that the Air Force recruiters were going to be, Air Corps recruiters, Army mm-hmm. Air Corps recruiters, were going to be such and such a location on the campus on such and such a day. And so I went and enlisted so that I wouldn't get in too much trouble with the draft board. And
probably a wise decision.
It wasn't out of pure patriotism. You knew you were going to go, and I really thought this would be a lot better way to go than to be in the Army on the ground. And
let me ask you this. There in Lemoore, and you say it's 1,000 people or less, had you seen a lot of the young men disappear, get called up, and was that town a bit of a ghost town once all those young men joined the service?
No, not really. Never has was a ghost town, and I don't think we'll be for a long time yet. But actually, the older guys were gone, and mm-hmm. it shoved us into a position, I guess, of being the older guys when we were still 17.
So that
maybe 18. So.
That maybe was kind of fun.
Well, I guess it was, yeah. Yeah.
But that vacuum left there didn't seem to impact you too greatly. So you end up, you enlist in the Army Air Corps. Did you want to be a pilot right off the bat? Is that why you chose
I wanted to be a pilot, yeah, before then. I wanted to fly an airplane.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
So you thought, hey,
But I really didn't know how I was going to go about doing it. But
there's
until,
your answer.
Until this came along.
All right.
And I made it, so.
What was your welcome to the military moment? Was it what you expected, or did you get into it a day or two or a week or two and say, oh, I didn't expect all this. I don't know what I got myself into here.
Well, in the first place, you're in the Army. You're not in the Air Force. You're mm-hmm. in the Army. And we reported to Fort Snelling in Minneapolis and then by train went to Jefferson Barracks, Missouri. And we thought it was cold in North Dakota, but that cold, damp air being close to the Mississippi was more than, you know, real cold. And a lot of marching, and no, I really didn't think I was going to get into that. I wanted to get into airplanes.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, it straightens you out.
You grow up real fast, huh?
You bet, yeah.
How long was it before you got to get in an airplane and get up in the air? And what did that feel like when you did?
Well, we went in February of 43, and that spring we were at Jefferson. We were at Michigan State. There was too many of us to be assimilated into the pilot training program. So they farmed us out to all these colleges around the country, and they called them college training detachments. And I was at Michigan State for one full quarter. And while there, they took us over to the airport and let us take a ride in a Piper Cub with a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was after I enlisted in service, that was my first flight, which didn't seem that unusual or, you know, at the time.
And a Piper Cub handles just like a B-24, right?
Just about.
Did you want to fly fighters or bombers? Did you care?
Well, I think all of us wanted to be a hot pilot and fly a P-51.
Mm-hmm.
And that was going to be our airplane. And you come along through the training program, and I was in basic flight training. No. Yeah, basic flight training. And we had the opportunity to apply for either a single engine advance or dual engine advance or possibilities of flying in a bomber.
Mm-hmm.
Also, at the same time, they announced if you're over 5'10 and 160 pounds, don't bother to apply for fighter plane.
Too big for the cockpit.
Well, I assumed that's what it was, and I was more than that in both instances. So,
you and me both.
I didn't even try. I just went along with the game and went to a dual engine advanced training and eventually was on a crew and in a B-24.
Now, the first time that you saw a B-24, did you look at it and say, that thing's supposed to fly? I'm supposed to be able to maneuver that?
No, impossible. How does it get off the ground? I mean, you walk under that little narrow wing and look up in that huge body. Of course, now they go underneath the wing of some of these planes. But anyway, it was a big one then.
And affectionately known in some circles as a flying anvil. Huh? Have you ever heard it called that?
Yes, I've heard it called many things. Yeah, yeah. But well, you know, to look at it, you wouldn't think it could fly. But it was a good airplane.
Did you warm up to it pretty quickly? Did you learn to appreciate the benefits that it had?
Well, you flew it. Mm-hmm. You flew it. It was not an easy job. During a training period in the B-24, you had a lot of formation flying and that sort of thing, and so you'd trade off. You know, the pilot would fly it, and you'd fly it, and there's no such thing as automatic pilot when you're in a formation. And you'd get out of that plane after a long training mission, and your wrist would ache from handling the controls, and you're bent over. You gotta.
I've had some B-24 pilots tell me that it took quite a bit of upper body strength just in liftoff to be able to pull back and get it off the ground.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. As a co-pilot, I didn't do that immediately, but I had a good pilot. I've heard of stories about co-pilots never having an opportunity to do this, but I don't know what we were there for if we didn't.
Uh-huh.
Never. I don't think it ever entered my pilot's mind, because as soon as we started flying, just he and I handling the airplane, I had to do everything he did.
Of course. You know, and absolutely.
So.
Well, and when you get all that chest workout, lifting it off, then you just can stick that chest out a little further for the ladies, right?
That's right. That's right.
Now, you're going to celebrate your 65th wedding anniversary this year, so you were not married yet when you entered the service.
No, but I was married right after we graduated from cadet training, right after I got my pilot's wings. In fact, we went together in high school, senior year in high school. And I think her mother sent her out to the rest of the family in Seattle as soon as we got out of high school, probably just to get her away from me. And 2 years later, we were married, so it worked temporarily. And we communicated, well, by letter mostly after that, but by phone once in a while. You know, it's not like today. You'd scare up enough quarters and go to a pay phone, and you'd had to make sure she was going to be at the phone at the other end you were calling before you did it. So that was done by letter. And then you'd visit for 3 minutes, or sometimes you went over and have to put some more quarters in it when you hung up. But
times have changed.
Yeah.
But you left behind a brand new bride when you went off overseas with the 459th Bomb Group, the 757th Bomb Squadron of the 459th Bomb Group of the 15th Air Force in Europe. We're going to talk about that when we come back. It's Hometown Heroes today. Jerry Gleasing of Spokane, Washington, our guest. You're listening to News Talk 580 KMJ. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, joined today by former prisoner of war in the European theater, Jerry Gleasing. He lives in Spokane, Washington, and as I travel across the western United States with the Bulldog basketball team, thought I'd demonstrate that there are not heroes in just our hometowns in the San Joaquin Valley, but all over this great country of ours. No matter where you go, you will find men and women who have put their lives on the line for our freedom, and something that we don't want to forget. That's what this program's all about. When we left off with Jerry Gleasing, we talked about how he had been married during his training, went overseas with not only a brand new bride or a fairly new bride, but also a bun in the oven. Your wife was expecting when you went to Europe?
Yes, yeah.
Did
we'd been married about, 3 months or so before I went overseas.
Uh-huh. And you didn't waste a lot of time. And so, but I imagine that weighs on you as you head overseas, not knowing if you're going to come back. You've got a wife, and now there's this baby that you might not be there when that baby's born.
Well, I didn't plan on not coming back. I planned on coming back.
Funny how that works.
It never entered my mind that I wasn't going to come back.
And so you get over there, and this is with the 15th Air Force, the 459th Bomb Group, the 757th Bomb Squadron, flying B-24s. Tell me about your first mission. Any butterflies before that?
No, not really. You just went out like you did every day for training. You knew it was going to be a mission. I even forget what we call it now, but prior to going, you met in the group training office with all the crew and the whole works. And we were informed that we went to Verona, Italy, which would be a short mission compared to some of those on up into Austria and so on. But we were informed that they had, mobile training, mobile air and anti-aircraft guns mounted on the train, and that they were located just as soon as you get over land. Why, they're going to see you, and they were right, because we went up the Adriatic Sea, and as soon as we turned to go into Verona, why, the 88 started popping around us. And even then, we had the chaff in the plane, like tinfoil.
Mm-hmm.
Guys would throw a couple boxes of chaff out of the waste gunner windows, and that would throw the radar off.
Right.
So the German 88 cannon would be popping way behind us, and then it would catch up again.
And you're flying in formation, right?
Oh, yeah, you just sit there. Yeah.
So if there's flak right in front of you.
Well, you know they're not going to hit you. They're all around you. But they shake the airplane, you know, when they go off. And they hit you. You know, there was a lot of holes in the airplane when it got done, but it flew fine.
But you can't dodge it. You have to stay in formation and stay on the course.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
You can't try to miss this flak that's coming at
no,
you.
No.
So you're hearing the rat-a-tat-tat. You're seeing the black smoke all over the place.
And you can feel it when one of them explodes and it throws the airplane. The pilot did get hit just as we dropped our bombs on the first mission. And he had 5 missions as a co-pilot.
Uh-huh.
5 missions where he had to fly 5 missions before he took his crew. Not all necessarily right. All as a co-pilot.
Right, right.
And so it was our first flight, the rest of the crew's first flight. And just as we dropped our bombs, he got hit. And of course, you're looking around, looking at the instruments, looking out like you're supposed to do. And this one was particularly close and really shook the airplane. And I looked over at him to say, planning to say something or think about motion, but that was close. And here he was hanging on the wheel with blood pouring down past him and his arms just hanging down there. And I just thought he was gone. So very unceremoniously jerked him off the wheel so I could get control of the airplane and got the turret gunner, the engineer that was in the Martin turret up above to get him out of the seat and stayed in formation pretty well. Got a little loose there trying to keep things all figured out.
I can imagine. There's a lot going on here.
Well, there is then. We just dropped our bombs and they go into a rally. Well, we've had a lot of practice rallies, you know, and they weren't so bad. I'd flown in a lot of them. But this was a rally. I mean, this was combat.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we dove that old B-24. And I don't know what our speed got up to, but it was pretty fast compared to others. And
those flying anvils drop pretty fast.
They go down fast with power, with power. They have power. But anyway, we kept it in formation fairly well and finally got out over the water where there was nobody shooting at us again. And actually, we got away from the railroad flat cars that were shooting at us with the cannons.
Now, is this a mission? Did you guys have fighter escort, or are you just the B-24s?
No, we had fighter escort, but, you know, I didn't see a German fighter. They were out there. You know.
It's just all anti-aircraft. Yeah.
That's another thing about a P-51 pilot. You're already in the air, and he's just getting out of bed. You know.
There's no rivalry here.
But anyhow, we made it back out, and the first pilot was hit, and I knew I had to get him to. I felt he was worse off than he was. And so
was he conscious at all, talking to you?
Well, he was out. No, he was out.
And you thought he was dead?
We were pulling him out of there. He was just dead weight getting him out of there.
Uh-huh.
And so I really, honest to God, thought he was dead. But
you probably hadn't expected to be flying the plane, to be solely at the controls.
I didn't expect
mission.
To be in at all. Didn't expect to be in charge at all.
Uh-huh. No.
But anyway, it turned out that way. And we got out over the water, and somebody in the, I'm in number 5 position, I think it was, in the formation. There's six in the squadron there. And number 4, which is an easier position to fly in, and it's right behind the number 1, they had a person injured really badly and had to get him to a hospital right now. And at that time, Joe was kind of coming too. So he was talking to the Martin gunner back there, the Martin turret gunner. And so they told this guy where to go to get to him to a hospital right away. I think actually a tail gunner had his foot shot off or something.
And you're hearing this on the radio?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And actually when you're the co-pilot, you're keeping track of what's going on inside the airplane with the crew, and the first pilot is listening to what's going on outside. All the way in and all the way out, you're no talking.
Right.
And so anyway, as soon as we got, then when that happened to Joe, I had to keep track of both. So I'd switch back and forth. Well, I heard him tell the guy out in the number 6 position to move into number 4. And I thought, well, I wished I could have been in there. And I looked out, and he was so far out there, it didn't make any difference. I just moved into number 4. And I had my lie all made up that if I was going to fly at home alone, and he would take him a long time to get into number 4, I thought I'd just move in there.
Uh-huh.
So I wasn't going to lie about not hearing the message. I just decided I was going to take it. And I did. I never heard another word about it. So anyway, that's...
So
and Joe was had come to already about this time, and I knew it. So before we got back to the base, he was in the pilot seat again, but he couldn't see anything. Actually, this eye was, both eyes were almost closed, mm-hmm. but the left eye was completely closed on him. And so he read the checklist, which would have been my job to him, mm-hmm. The way around. And then I landed the airplane and had an ambulance meet us at the end of the runway, and they took him off to the hospital. So, and he was back, probably 2 a.m. He comes into the tent, and he had no damage to his eyeball at all. It was glass. It was all around his eye.
How about that?
And so he was very fortunate. It took us till the swelling went down before he could fly again. So probably a week or so before we were in the air again doing another practice mission or something. We practiced overseas between missions.
Uh-huh. So you were he was going to be on your crew for the next mission as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, nothing was happening in between time. Nobody said, you're going to now be the first pilot or you're going to get assigned to another crew or we're going to break up your crew or anything like that.
So you got back on the ground that day. This is your very first mission of the war.
Yeah.
Your pilot had been shot. You had to take over, land the plane. You get down there. There's bullet holes in the plane or flak damage.
A lot of damage to the skin of the plane. A lot of holes in the plane.
Uh-huh.
But, the window next to his head had a hole about the size of a quarter. That's why I thought some shrapnel had come right through and hit him.
But it was the glass from that window.
But it was the slivers of glass.
We
never did find any shrapnel in the plane at all that I know of.
So what do you think after all that? You didn't expect any of that. It's kind of incredible to survive something like that. Do you have a stiff drink, as a lot of pilots do? Do you say a prayer? How do you process what you just went through?
You do pray. But anyhow, on the way back to interrogation, which you have after a mission.
The debrief and the whole crew.
We were apparently the lead bombardier group that day, and I'd kind of forgotten about that, except that the lead bombardier, or the bombardier that had the group dropping the bomb, was in the same truck going to, and he was our man from our group. And I think he was the first lieutenant or something, and he looked at me, and he... A lot of people call me Red because of my complexion and little hair and so on. And he said, this is your first mission, isn't it? And I said, yes, it is. He says, well, you'll have 24 more, and you'll never see that much flak again. And
we'll find out if those words proved true or not for Jerry Gleasing. And I want to ask before we take this next commercial break, when you got down that day and you realized what you'd just been through, and yes, that is your first mission, and you're thinking, if they're all going to be like this, I'm in trouble. Did you think about your wife and your pregnant wife back home and what might be left for them?
I just knew I was going to make it. I still didn't. I went through that one. I didn't think anything else was going to happen to me. That's all.
Well, you're here talking to me, so it couldn't have been that bad.
No. I don't recall actually how I felt about it. But.
Well, we're going to take another break, but when we come back, we're going to, by the end of the show, we're going to discuss every mission that Jerry flew in World War II, and we'll start with the second mission next. How are we going to have time for all that? You'll understand when we come back. It's Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, continuing on with Jerry Gleasing, who was a B-24 pilot during World War II. You heard him talk about his first mission, so now let's talk about his second mission, and it couldn't have been as hairy as that first one. We just heard all about it. What was the object? Where were you headed on mission number two? And you had Joe, your pilot, back with you?
Yeah, he was back. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we were it was over 2 weeks from the first mission to the second mission because he had to heal up, and then you have to always wait for the proper weather and that sort of thing.
And it's pretty cold. This is January 15th, 1945?
January 15th was my second mission.
Uh-huh.
And we were going to Vienna, Austria, to bomb a marshaling yard there. And we did. We made it up to Vienna all right, and the flak didn't seem as bad as the day we went into northern Italy, and it was kind of more off in the distance. I looked across at another group of planes that were getting hit a lot harder than we were, and apparently we got hit. I don't know for sure if we got hit, but as we left, dropped our bombs, and as we went into the rally and left, we started losing engines. And we lost an engine, and eventually the prop winds up and ran away on us and had to eventually use the feathering button to get it down.
Mm-hmm.
And and it wouldn't hold. You let go of it a little bit, and it'd start winding up again. So if you let them go, they might fly off of there. But if they don't and just the engine stops, they'll just sit out there and windmill, and they're a terrible drag that way. So we feathered the engine, and it was dead, and the props turned into the wind or into the... So that was the lightest load. And we looked at each other. The rest of them were gone by then. They had left us.
But everybody had bailed out of the plane.
No, we were still in it. We still had three engines.
Oh, you mean the rest of the planes?
Still had engines. We thought we were going to make it home all right. We had three engines.
But all the rest of the planes in your formation are still going full speed. So you're all alone.
You got a little bit lonesome because they were higher than you, and they took off and disappeared.
Gotcha.
And eventually we lost three engines. And we to this day, I, of course, don't know what really caused it all, but we did lose them all in the same manner. And got down to one, and we couldn't hold altitude, or we couldn't hold speed or anything. So we finally, the pilot gave the order to bail out, and by now we were over hungry. And that's when we all bailed out.
Did that seem to go by very quickly, or did it seem to be dragging on and kind of torturing you for a while?
Well, we were trying to get that plane going so we could get home, so I just can't tell you if it seemed like it was...
It sounds pretty intense.
Dragging out, but we were busy. We were very busy. And time didn't seem that important. It just tried to get it going again so we could get out of here. But
so here they told you, your first mission, you'll never have one quite like that again. 24 more, that gives you 25. You get to go home and see your wife. And then your son, Michael, right?
Yeah, we expected a son.
But
didn't turn out that way, but that's what we expected.
But Joe, your captain, your pilot, gives the order, bail out,
yeah. And we were still there fussing with it, trying to make it go, and I assumed that all the rest of the crew was gone, and I was getting nervous about the altitude, and he was still working with that thing, and so I finally got out of the seat and hit him on his shoulder, and I said, Joe, I'm leaving, or I'm going, whatever I said. And I get back to the Bombay, which is just a short distance there, and here's the engineer squatted down, ready to go out of the hole, and the navigator right behind him. And he doesn't go, and he stands back up. So we're screaming at him to go, go, go. So the next time he gets down, the navigator didn't give him a chance to stand back up again. He just got on him and shoved him out through the Bombay. And then he went, and then I went. And the rest of the crew was on the ground by then, I'm sure.
And you didn't know when or if Joe was going to get out of the plane.
That's another thing that bothered me, because he didn't get out of the seat right away, and as far as I knew, he was still there when I went out the door. And I worried about that for a long time. He did land in Yugoslavia, which was on the other side of the river. There's a short distance there where there's a river that's the border between Hungary and Yugoslavia. And he landed on the other side.
So you are out the Bombay doors. Your parachute's deployed. You're floating down toward a place you've never been before. You have no idea what's going to greet you. What's going through your mind as you coast down toward...
Oh, that's the first thing that hit me was the chute opened up, and I'm still there, and I had this escape bag wrapped around my hand so that I could have something on the ground when I got there, a little food in it, and that's a .45 automatic pistol in it.
Mm-hmm.
But the first thing that hit me when that chute opened up and I looked down, I thought, oh, gosh, I haven't got a friend in the world down there that I know about anyway. So anyway, that's the first thought I had. I've got a friend down there.
And you think about your wife? When the baby to come?
Well, at that point, I didn't. When I hit the ground and got free of my parachute, and I like to tell that I was not nervous about it at all, I got up and started running, and when I hit the end of the ropes of the parachute, why, it pulled me back on the ground again. But I knew what I was doing at all times. Anyway, then I jerked myself out of the parachute and was up, and I hear these guys come out of the woods, you know, and they're carrying tools of their trade. Someone would have a pick in his hand, and another one, a shovel, and that kind of stuff. And
these are Hungarian civilians.
They are Hungarians. I didn't realize they were Hungarians at the time. I didn't know exactly where we were. And so, in fact, our navigator had told us how far we were from the Russian line, and that maybe we could make it, but we didn't. And anyway, these guys come running out of there, and I was scared. And so I was running the other way, and I saw the nose gunner. So I ran over to him. And I just thought I was scared. He could not talk. His teeth were chattering. And I heard of people's teeth chattering, but I saw it. And he couldn't do anything, just stand there. So that calmed me down considerably because I got more concerned about him. But during that period of time of running, from the time I knew I had to try to run away from these people, that's when I daily did the praying, and all I could think about was my wife and the new baby that was coming along.
Uh-huh. So our listeners are clear, these Hungarian civilians were after you because you guys had been bombing their villages. They saw you as the enemy.
Right? Yes, I suppose, but I was out in a kind of a rural area, and they were not hostile at all once they caught up to us.
Oh, really? Well, let's get to that part of the story.
So that helps, too. And I have no idea anymore how many there were, but probably a dozen.
Uh-huh.
And what was I, 19? Well, I guess I was 20.
Uh-huh.
And here's these guys that you're now at their mercy, and they're standing there asking who you are and that kind of stuff, and you tell them I don't know if you're Amerikonski, and you tell them yes. And I'm looking each one of them in the eye for some reason or other, and I see this one guy in the second row. He was kind of older than the rest of them, and I just thought to myself then, boy, it was just you and I out here. We'd figure out how to get out of this thing, wouldn't we? So I thought I had a friend, but by then some Hungarian soldiers actually showed up. So they were in charge, and these other guys just kind of disappeared back to their work, I guess. So they finally rounded us all up in a truck, actually, and hauled us into town, little town there. But we were all there except Joe, who was the first pilot, who wasn't.
Uh-huh.
And then I didn't know what had happened to him. I just didn't know what had happened to him. I just had hoped that he got out of the plane. He was in it longer than we were, so maybe he was still out there someplace, and maybe he was okay, but I didn't know.
And none of you knew what was going to happen to you, but I imagine it was a bit comforting to have the rest of your crew there with you, to not be on your own and completely alone.
That's very true. That's very true. There seemed to be strength in numbers or a feeling of safety in numbers, and even then, with just the crew, you didn't really feel comfortable until you got into a prison camp with several thousand people, you know.
Well, you've heard plenty of stories of prisoners of war being shot before they ever got to a prison camp. Malmedy Massacre comes to mind.
Right.
Hadn't been too probably only a month and a half before that or so. So what did happen to you? Did they march you? Did they put you in a 40 and 8? What'd they do?
Well, we were in a passenger train for a while. I wound up getting interrogated every step of the road, and I didn't know really what they were doing that for, because you could only tell them your name, rank, and serial number, and that's the end of it, and then you try to switch the subject to something else, and they'd get you back. And
did you ever have an interrogator who knew more about you than you knew about yourself?
Well, he knew where I was from, or where my family was from in Germany. They shipped all the Air Force people up to Frankfurt for interrogation.
Uh-huh.
And they had a big interrogation center there.
Was that Dulag Luft?
I don't know what the name of it was. Uh-huh. It was just an interrogation center in Frankfurt, Germany.
Yep.
And I thought I was there 9 days because it seemed like longer than that. Maybe it was less than that. I'm not sure anymore. But it probably was less than that. But it seemed forever. I was in a room, didn't have a window.
Uh-huh.
And the only daylight I had was the crack under the door. I could see the light coming in there. So that way you knew which direction was up. And there was very, very, very little heat in there.
And this is January 1945.
Yeah.
Brr.
Yeah.
Coldest winter ever in Germany.
Very cold winter. Coldest winter on record yet in Germany.
So how do you pass the time in that situation?
I had a comb in my pocket. And there was a radiator in the room, heat. Hot water, and I would take a tooth out of that comb, and I would try to see if I could melt it on that cold radiator. That was one of the things, and it didn't work, but that was one of the things I did. You had nothing, you know, it's dark, and you either lay down, sit up, or stand up, and so we did get fed twice a day. You know, and if you had to go to the bathroom, they had a handle out there, you could drop the arm. But without being told, I think if you drop that thing too frequently, and then they'd let you out to go to the bathroom.
Uh-huh.
Maybe they'd ignore you. And if it happened to be a time when you really had to go to the bathroom, you didn't want them ignoring you.
Don't want to be the boy who cried wolf.
Yeah.
So. In their interrogations of you, they ever threaten you? They ever scare you, intimidate you?
Well, at Frankfurt, even before I got to Frankfurt, I was threatened with going to a concentration camp because, I'm not going to do that. I'm in the Army, and I got dog tags and all that. Well, anybody can make those.
Right.
Know? And you can get that Army uniform if they want you over here as a spy or something, which was all a joke, but they just tried to scare you, you know, and threaten you with the concentration camp. And at Frankfurt, this guy was asking me questions, and all of a sudden these huge few footsteps behind me, and I look around, and here's this guy with a gun, not pointed at me, but with a row of bullets here. I call them bullets. Another one here.
Uh-huh. Bandoliers over his shoulders?
Bandoliers, that's the right word. And so he made you a little nervous, but he didn't do anything. He just stood there. But let you know he was in charge, I guess. Some of that's a little bit hazy now, but I can remember talking to that guy, and it was warm. I wasn't in that black cell.
Mm-hmm.
It was warm, and he had cigarettes, so I'd ask him, where do you get your tobacco? He said, from Turkey. He'd give you a cup of that ersatz coffee that didn't terrible taste and stuff, but and I wasn't even a coffee drinker at that time, but you drank it anyway. Went into one of the bathroom one time, and here was a guy that couldn't get up to the toilet to do what he wanted to do, and because his legs were broken.
From his interrogation?
So, no, I don't know how they got broke.
Yeah.
I assumed it was in combat.
Oh, okay.
But you might be right. But anyway, I held him up to the toilet so he could go to the bathroom. And all of a sudden, the guards realized there was two people in there. And they come charging in there, you know, the Ralph Smitten, whatever they said. And I guess we were done by that time because I had to leave him. And nobody had done it. I asked him if anybody was helping him. He says, no. But he says, well, he was on a plane because he said, I'm only about three of us survived or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that meant a lot to him at the time. We need to take our final commercial break here, Jerry, but when we come back, we're going to get the rest of your POW experience and find out how many of your children wouldn't be here if you didn't make it home. The number might surprise you back there at home. Jerry Gleasing, our guest today, back with the rest of Hometown Heroes next on News Talk 580 KMJ. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Coming down the home stretch, the time always goes by way too fast, and no exception today with Jerry Gleasing, who lives in Spokane, Washington. He was a prisoner of war in Europe. You heard him describe bailing out of that B-24 after just his second mission, being captured on the ground, being interrogated time and time again. And finally, they moved you to a prison camp in Nuremberg, Germany.
Right.
Stalag 13D? Is that
13D.
Right?
Had Italian prisoners in it. We didn't get moved right in with them. We were in a separate area. There was about 100 people there, 100 soldiers that were captured in the Battle of the Bulge. They were all enlisted men
that
were in that camp before. I say 100. I don't know if there was 100 or 200. They were in another barracks. But and they were using them to bury people in town. They'd haul them into town to bury people. But anyway, a short time later, and all these Italian people that were interned for political reasons, I guess, were moved out. And they left, and the American prisoners of war were moved in.
Mm-hmm.
And they cleaned up those barracks, and they had big piles of stuff, and the Germans let them burn it to clean up. And I guess it was...
And you still had most of your crew with you? All went to the same camp?
At this time, you just had Joe and Jackson, a navigator, and myself. And a bombardier that we'd picked up just for that mission.
And Joe was your pilot.
Joe's the pilot.
You didn't know what happened to him, but then he did end
up with
you there.
I didn't have him there. That's right. I said I had him there. I didn't have him yet.
But he would show up there.
But he showed up at Nuremberg about probably a week after we got there and moved right into the barracks that I was in. And so he and I commandeered a bunk there, and we slept together the rest of the winter there.
Try to stay warm in the coldest winter ever. Did that give you some relief to know that he was okay, to see his face again?
A lot of relief. A lot of relief. I was extremely pleased to see him come walking in there.
And you have no idea at this time how long the war is going to rage on. But as we know now, it was within 3 months of the end of the war. And the Germans were very short on supplies. It was hard to get anything anywhere. And these POW camps weren't exactly luxurious accommodations. The food was very sparse.
Yeah, it was. And no Red Cross parcels. We'd heard about them, but we didn't get any. And... one time we got one shipment of Red Cross parcels that we divided between six people, which was good, compared to what we'd had before.
And if you get the soup and there's a little maggot in it or something?
One night we had potatoes in that soup, and I looked across at Joe, and I said, you know, we could make it a long time if we had a meal like this every night. you know. But you talk about, I never had any, at that point in time, I never had any thought about not getting out of there. You have complete faith in the United States, they're going to come and get you. Even the short while I was there, I think if you didn't have that kind of faith, it's condition, you would have gotten a lot worse shape.
It was hard to get. How much weight did you end up losing?
Probably 50 pounds, 40 pounds. I think I was about 140 pounds when I got out. You know, you didn't get weighed for a couple, at least a week or more after you got out. But my first weight put me up to 160 pounds, and I was about 190 when I went down.
Uh-huh. And a lot of the POW camps in Europe, when we hear about liberation, they're quickly transported to Camp Lucky Strike, and before long they're sent home. And
right.
Most of them eat a real meal for the first time and can't hold it down because their stomachs are so out of shape. Your situation was a little different. They actually liberated you guys April 3rd, 1945, and then said, you're going to have to walk a little bit?
No, not me. April 29.
April 29.
April 29.
Okay. But then you had to march, right?
No, not I.
Okay, that was the rest of the guys.
They put us on a truck and took us over to, we were sleeping, we were only in, we went from Nuremberg down to Moosburg. That's where we marched.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry. That's where we marched. We had to walk down there. And it took quite a while because I guess, I don't think they realized that we were coming. They didn't have any accommodations for us. The place was full. And so we just slept out on the ground when we got there. I was only there a couple of weeks and before the front went through and we were liberated, and then they flew us out of there. Yeah.
And I imagine that felt pretty nice.
Well, the two greatest sights of my life, one of them was the American flag going up on the flagpole in that camp, because then you knew we were in charge.
And this is in Moosburg at Stalag 7A?
7A at Moosburg.
Uh-huh. So they moved you in early April from Nuremberg
right
down to Moosburg.
Yeah, we left Nuremberg April 14th, and we got into Moosburg April 4th, we got into Moosburg 10 days later.
Uh-huh. And then on the 29th, you see that flag go up. You're liberated. And pretty soon you're going to be going home, and there might be a baby there waiting for you.
And there is. I fully expected that. I didn't know. I knew we had Michael until I got off the plane in New York, or off the boat in New York, and got my way to a pay phone, got some quarters, and called my wife. And first I wanted to know how she was and all that. And she says, well, don't you want to know something? And, of course, I did. And what do we have? And she says, we have a girl, Mary Jean. But the other site was the Statue of Liberty.
I've heard so many veterans say that. What did that mean to you?
It's your home.
That's beautiful. What you were fighting for, huh?
You bet. Beautiful. Yeah.
And I can tell it's still emotional for
still,
you now.
It still is, yeah. It probably wasn't then, but it's more now than it was then.
What about when you saw your daughter for the first time?
Well, we got home into Fargo. My wife came and met me came to Fort Snelling and met me in Minneapolis, and we were there a couple of days. And then when we got home to Fargo, and she was living in an apartment, an ordinary home that had been turned into five apartments. And another lady there took care of her while Nancy was down. And in fact, her mom had been visiting her just before that. So then this other lady took her. We went to her apartment, and this little baby was laying on the davenport, and she just rose up and looked, and that was the first time I saw my daughter. Yeah.
I imagine that's a pretty unforgettable moment for
you.
Yeah,
it is. It is.
So she was going to be here no matter what, but if you hadn't made it back from Stalag 13D and Stalag 7A and survived the war, how many more Gleasings, how many more children would not have been here if you hadn't made it back?
Well, we had a total of seven, so I guess that's six.
And how many grandkids now?
Incidentally, how many grandkids? About 15.
All right. Incidentally, what?
Well, we were going to have Michael, and we had five boys total, and Michael didn't make it.
You found seven other names.
They're all something else, yeah.
Absolutely. When you look back on it now, how do you account for what happened to you? Why do you think you got to come home and have seven children and 15 grandchildren in the life that you've had?
I know you start this program by talking about heroes. Well, the heroes, really, most of them didn't come home. And you never feel like you're a hero. You're not a hero. You're just not a hero.
I know that a lot of veterans share that sentiment, that the 400,000 Americans who gave their lives in World War II were the real heroes. But to me and my generation, you are a hero. And you served selflessly. You spent time as a POW for our freedom and for our country, and we greatly appreciate it. Jerry, thanks so much for sharing some of those experiences with us. And enjoy your big family, even if you are all Washington State Cougars.
Well, we do. No, I've got one now that's gone to the dogs.
Gonzaga Bulldog. All right. Well, the Fresno State Bulldogs will have it out for you guys.
Yeah.
That's Jerry Gleasing, our guest today. We'll be back with another edition next week. Hometown Heroes, as always, right here on News Talk 580 KMJ.